This week on the Back Table Podcast.
Sometimes those transitions are needed when you figure out what you're running towards, right? What is happening today isn't working. You have articulated this amazing vision of what your future needs to look like. And, you know, like Gopi, you said, sometimes it's that hard realization that you have outgrown the place where you are, right? Or you have outgrown the parameters that were helpful to you as you were going through X, Y, or Z thing. But now you have evolved. The shoe doesn't fit anymore, and you got to do something else.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Back Table ENT Podcast. We're a podcast that focuses on all things otolaryngology, and we've got a really great show for you today. Thanks for stopping by. I'm Ashley Agan. I will be one of your hosts, joined by the one, the only, the lovely Gopi Shah. Good morning, Gopi.
Hello, Ash. Good morning. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so excited to be here with you as always. And I'm very, very excited for our guest and our topic today. Should I go ahead and introduce our guest?
Please.
We have Dr. Jennifer Vilwack. She's an associate professor in the Department of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery at Kansas University Medical Center, where she's the vice chair for research and innovation. She's also the section chief of Otolaryngology Kansas City Veterans Affairs Hospital, the VA. Her clinical practice is in rhinology, and her research interests are in personalized medicine and pain and olfaction. Jen is here today to talk to us about career transitions. Welcome to the show, Jen. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
It's so nice to have you on and see you. You know, we always start our show with having you tell us a little bit about yourself and your practice.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, as you mentioned, my practice, most of my clinical practice is in rhinology and skull-based surgery, as that's when I did my fellowship training in. And then I do see patients over at the VA hospital as well, which is more of a hodgepodge. So I like to think that that keeps me on my toes, so I'm not just always in the rhinology realm. But a lot of my career, especially in the past couple of years, has really been transitioning to a focus on research. And for me, you know, I think that research is a field where you get to ask questions about things that bother you and then find the answers to those questions. So for me, there's nothing more fun than having recently started to transition my career more towards the research realm.
And in addition to that, you've also kind of put on the coaching hat too, right? Talk to us a little bit about that, how that came to be.
Yeah, so coaching is something that I had really not been aware of until probably 2 or 3 years ago. So to take a step back, when I was a resident, I had done some research on imposter syndrome, which I think is very commonly referred to now, but back then it was not something that was really commonplace in terms of things that folks talked about. And in my residency training program, we were just noticing differences in how different people reacted to similar seeming scenarios. And we were like, well, why is it that some of us, we come out of whatever experience it is, and the only thing that we can say to ourselves is negative things, right? Or how we should have been better, or how we're just not good enough. And not everybody has that experience. And again, being a research nerd, I was like, well, we should study this and see, you know, how prevalent this is within our field and within medicine. And I think a natural extension of that, fast forwarding now several years, is to get into the realm of coaching. And I think that there are a lot of different definitions of coaching, just like there's a lot of different styles and definitions of mentorship. But the one that I ascribe to is really, you know, the role of the coach is to help the person who's being coached understand what are their values. What are the things that are most important to them? What's that vision for their best life and their best self? And then what are the steps that we can take to get there? So for some people, that involves, you know, stretching out and finding new realms that they want to explore, or new ways that they want to manifest their awesomeness in different aspects of their career that maybe they hadn't thought about before. And I think for a lot of us in medicine, that's a little different than all of our training, which is where you just kind of put your head down and you do the check marks that somebody else already determined for you. And then you get done and you're like, did I win the game? Now what? Right? Like, what is the actual next step? Who am I and what do I still care about after I did all these check marks?
You know, just full disclosure, I've had several coaching sessions with Jen and they've been awesome. And I get, so in the beginning, I feel like, okay, I'm coming so caught up in the check marks, the boxes, all these things I should be doing and the noise. And at the end of the session, it is nice to have some clarity with, wait, what's important to me? And then have some actionable steps to take. And then also expand my vocabulary when I had to look up equanimity. But so there's some bonuses as well. Tell us a little bit about, you know, when you're saying, okay, in the last couple of years, I've transitioned a little bit more to research. What does that entail? Tell us a little bit about your journey.
So I always knew that I was a research-oriented person in terms of, I think people approach their research projects in a variety of different ways. And some folks, you know, they find a mentor and then they just kind of tackle the newest and greatest things that are similar to what their mentor does. The approach that I've always taken is, what do I see in clinical practice or in education or whatever realm that doesn't make sense? And then how do we make it better? Because a lot of times the answer is just a big fat, it's just how we've done it. So that, and nobody has questioned it or trying to find something better. And I have just really been open to exploring the things that are of interest to me. And there is, I think, especially at the level of folks that are reviewing grants and looking at and assessing people's career trajectories, there's an older school of thought that is like, no, you have to, like, from the time you enter into science, you pick like this one thing and this is the thing that you study and that's your trajectory. But I think it's becoming much more apparent that where the real value is an exploration and also in interacting with people in other domains. And so I have received feedback on some of my grant submissions where the feedback is directly about me, not about the science. And they'll say things like, oh, she's very opportunistic because I have a smattering of things that I'm interested in. So I have publications and a bunch of things that seem unrelated. And that feedback stings slightly, but I think it also reflects who is reviewing, right? These are people that grew up in the trajectory where you just pick your one thing and love it or hate it, that's what you stick with. Versus a lot of the newer folks that I've talked to that are, you know, at my career stage and within my generation, they're very much like me in terms of, who are these people to tell me what I may or may not be interested in? And I think it's much more of a transition toward, what are you interested in and what do you want to explore? And if that's five things, that's great. And over time, you'll see what pans out, what doesn't, what you stay interested in, and what continues to resonate with you. And then you can pick, you know, the handful of things that you'll continue to explore.
Yeah. In preparing, you know, as I was thinking about this conversation, that generational aspect did come up, you know, just thinking about how generations ahead of us tend to stay in the same career longer. There's a much bigger percentage of people who had a 30 or 40 year career doing, you know, basically that same thing, right? Whereas when you kind of look around at the, I guess, millennial generation or kind of younger generation coming up, the statistics looking across all career paths are more so that you see more changes in jobs and shifts and pivoting and evolution of one's kind of career identity. And so as we're coming up through medicine, we're looking to the generation ahead of us of kind of what things are supposed to look like. And yet I think we have, you know, we're different. We're a different generation. We've kind of grown up in a different landscape, and there's maybe some conflict there. I don't know. How do you think about that?
I think about that conflict in the context of values and really taking a step back and asking yourself, well, what do I value, not just about me as a person, but also in terms of what's my highest level of contribution to whatever field or realm that I'm in? Because certainly, you know, I received excellent clinical training. I could have a career that was 100% clinical medicine. But is that the thing, like, when I wake up in the morning, am I going to be like, yes, another full day of clinic? No, that's not the thought that I have when I wake up on my full clinic days oftentimes. And I think that where the value is like in, for me, my creative like research thoughts, the mentorship that I can provide, you know, to students, the coaching that I can provide to colleagues and others, where those are aspects of what I really care about that are somewhat unique and not as well represented in medicine. But I'll tell you one of the best tidbits of advice that I received when I was talking with an external mentor about how those of us who grew up in these clinical domains, which is basically everybody that goes through medical school, the value is always on clinical care. And to a large part, that is also what is valued from a financial perspective, right? Like, you only get the win from your grant if you get the grant funded. But if you look at what those numbers look like, it's the minority of people that fall into that bucket. And so I was just asking him, like, how does he navigate that, what the field values versus what you value, and then the finances that go into that. And he just looked at me and he was like, you have to get over yourself. He's like, it doesn't matter what these other people value you as. What do you value in terms of having a career and doing things that are aligned with the things that you care about the most? And at the end of the day, the reality right now is that that may not be as financially compensated as some of these other things. But understanding that 100 years from now, we're all dead. Anyway, you know, what did we do with our time on Earth, right? Did we use it to fulfill what other people thought we should be doing? Or did we use it to really explore the ways that we wanted to manifest as a complete human being?
It's interesting because I think when I think of career transitions, there is, you know, the light bulb that comes on of, wait a second, I'm doing all these shoulds, and especially in the career path of medical education and how we get to medical school and residency, fellowships, our first jobs, it's a lot of is directed by all these shoulds. And then you may hit a point. I remember hitting a point where I'm just like, I have all these things that I'm doing, but I don't know, why is it not filling me? Like, what's, I'm not excited. Like, what, why is that? And it's because I think I never spent time or figured out what was important to me. And then when I decided what was important to me, it's uncomfortable. Like it's a little scary because it's the conflict of what's important to you may not be important to the larger group outside or the quote noise that we're constantly hearing. How do you manage that discomfort and get comfortable in that new space? Because without that, you otherwise, I think at a point just feel stuck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I experiment with a lot of different thoughts that I try to practice, you know, because, you know, we know that the habitual thoughts, right, become stronger and stronger because you're basically just training your brain to immediately think different things. And so things that I try to think about when I'm in that scenario where it's like, well, do you want to make a couple more art views or do you want to spend this time doing this other thing? You know, for me, I try to think about how what society values and what I value don't have to be the same. And I think I already see in many other aspects of my life that those things are not aligned, right? And that creates much less conflict. So why is it so much more personal feeling when it comes just to the domain and the house of medicine? And the other thing that I think is really important and that is helpful is to have these sorts of conversations with today's medical students. Like depending on what sort of, you know, publication, et cetera, that you're reading, there's a lot of not just medical students, but nursing students, other health professionals. They're going through the training, but they already know. They're like, actually, this clinical career is not for me, right? So I think that if we want to recruit and retain people into the house of practicing clinical medicine, we also have to have these conversations about, well, what are the other areas that you can grow if you're already kind of feeling like maybe just the 100% clinical grind is not for you?
With your recent transition to be able to have a larger research footprint, just kind of thinking in general for people who are thinking, oh, you know, there's more aspects to my career that I want to explore. How do you embark on that? You know, how do you, you know, go to your chairman or your boss, if you're employed, or your partners and say, you know, I want to spend some more time doing this? And how did you kind of plan for that and anticipate kind of any sort of obstacles that might come with that transition?
I think, you know, this is what I'm about to say is very specific for folks in academics, because I think the things that you would have to troubleshoot are going to be very different in private practice, where historically, you know, the academic or research side has not been as robust. Although certainly there are people who are doing great research who are in private practice, but I think they're much more lower in proportion than when you look at academics. But I think the first thing to really do is to come up with some sort of game plan and understand, too, that there's an important distinction between running away from something and running towards something. So if you hear this and you're like, oh, yeah, Philbach's research life sounds great. She's only doing 40% clinical medicine. You don't just want to run into that space because you're running away from the things that you don't like about what your current setup is, right? So we want to be running towards, and I think that lets us be a little bit more intentional about the resources that we might need, as well as how we might access them. So if you're at an academic institution, there are all sorts of training grants and other things that will give you protected time so that it covers a portion of your salary you get plugged in with all of these very well-established researchers, both internally and externally, who can give you mentorship, help you refine your ideas. Because sometimes if you're the only person in your department who really wants to focus on research, you don't have like the person next door to you who you can then say, hey, can you take a look at my specifics aims page, et cetera. So you want to make sure that you're building kind of your connections within your institution. And then I think part of it is really having a solid game plan, right? So it takes a while to gather pilot data to be able to then launch yourself into one of these bigger federally funded grants. So what does that trajectory look like? What would your department startup plan be for someone who wants to pursue a research track? And what's the timeline and how are we measuring success? I think having those conversations is important. And if you're in a place where there have not been a lot of successful surgeon scientists, you may have to make the argument as well, you know, even though your time is not reimbursed as highly as it would be in clinical medicine, because the NIH, for example, has a salary cap that for a surgeon is relatively low. Well, how does that add value still to your department? Well, research drives rankings. Rankings drive patients wanting to come to your institution, which drives, you know, the clinical volume for the other people who are more clinically oriented and don't have this desire to be on a research track. So it all kind of plays into, you know, things that people value. So I think part of it is knowing what your leadership wants and how your goals can align with that.
I think that works really well for when we think about career academic medicine. And you said it's specific to academic medicine and doing more of a clinician or surgeon scientist research track. But we also have to think about different clinical transitions, whether it's practice type going from, you know, hospital employed to solo practice, for example, or academics to private or vice versa, or time going full time to cutting time is a transition. Entrepreneurship, carving out time if there's something you want to do with entrepreneurship or potentially innovation, med tech, or hey, you know, I want to teach a little bit more and having dedicated time for, you know, whatever it is that, you know, we want to teach, whether it's medical students, basic science to, you know, doing more with, for example, the fellow. And I do think it's figuring out what you value and then seeing, does that align with where I am? And then sometimes you just have to take that leap because it doesn't always align because it may be that what you want to do requires a different environment, different resources, or time that you're just not able to have in the current position that you're in. And that can be really difficult to kind of figure out whether the logistics of it too, because financially, like sort of how do you make some of those changes and things like that?
Yeah. And I think one thing that we don't do well, because we have never been taught to do it, is to think about things, you know, like to your point, Gopi, about, you know, all these other realms where there are structured ways to think about what your next step is. So like when you think about the entrepreneurship space, right, you're going to have some sort of business plan before you make your pitch to whomever. But we're not taught to do that. We're taught to just see patients, do the check boxes. That's your career. So then when you want to pivot, you don't have the skill set to be like, well, what are the general pros and cons and the finances of that.
Yeah.
Right? Like I avoid all things financial, right? Because I've always been taught not to value that. But yeah, if I'm thinking about, you know, as I'm managing these NIH budgets now, I'm like, oh, now I have to start getting into the Excels and understanding where is it best to put my research resources. And it's the same thing, I think, if you're going to be asking yourself and your family to put the whole group at some financial, you know, risk, you have to have some sort of data to back that up or some sort of understanding of like, what is the minimum that I need to achieve in order for pursuing this next thing to be viable? And how long are we willing to make that bet before we say this isn't going to work?
Yeah, I like your point about running away versus running toward. I think that's really powerful to, you know, framing to think about things. How do you know if you're running away or running toward? You know, like if you're kind of in the middle of this transition and you're kind of feeling that little stirring inside that's like, I'm unsettled. I, you know, want something new. How do you know if it's like, oh, I'm just unsatisfied with my current situation, or I'm longing for or wanting to run toward this other thing? And maybe that's where coaching comes in to help you kind of unpack that, you know, to hold a mirror up to you to kind of look into it. because you know, right? The answers are in you. Only you know what's the answer to that question, and that's how your coach helps you.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I think that's one of the things that I love about being in the role of coach, right? As opposed to clinical medicine, where you see a patient and you're supposed to like have the answer and like, here's the fix. As you said yourself, the role of being the coach is you're just the mirror, right? The person that you are coaching has all the answers inside of them. They know it, but they might not be able to articulate it or have never felt free to explore that particular line of thought before. So what you're doing as the coach is just providing a safe space for them to reflect and, you know, ask some deeper questions that maybe they haven't asked themselves before. And one of the exercises that we typically start with is, you know, trying to get at, well, what is your best version of yourself look like? So you're looking through the mirror, you're looking through the looking glass, and whatever is happening on the other side of that, that is the best version of you. You're happy, you're radiant, whatever that looks like for you. That person is over there and we're looking at her right now. So what is happening around her, right, that's resulting in this? Who is helping? What's the family doing, or what's the friends doing? What's the hobbies doing? What is contributing to this super happy and fulfilled version of you? And then how do we make incremental changes in your life now towards what that big goal is? And a lot of it too is being intentional about how you set your goals. You know, there's, if you Google SMART goals, right, it's an acronym. So you want it to be specific, measurable, doable, time limited, right? Because your goal cannot just be to be better. I'm like, okay, that's great. And I remember getting that feedback as a resident. One of my attendings was like, I need you to do what you just did, but better. And you're like, well, I can't do anything with that. So when we set these huge, lofty, undefined goals, it's hard to actualize on them.
Mine was, you need to do better on your in-service. I'm like, I guess I saw the number.
Thank you for that feedback.
I saw that. I know.
But then the question is how, right? How do we split that big goal into these little actionable tidbits so that number one, you can get that little dopamine hit of success. But number two, you can really kind of build the breadcrumb trail of where you've been and where you want to go and see where you want to continue growing, right? So maybe you want to pursue more of an entrepreneurial pathway. Tell you what, the NIH will support that, especially if you're a surgeon, because there's so few surgeons that are pursuing research and entrepreneurship. So maybe your goal is not to be the surgeon entrepreneur, too broad. Like, how are you going to get there? There's 1,000 steps and 1,000 potential pathways. So main goal for this week is you're going to hop on the NIH's website and look for all the training programs that you could go into that will protect some time, give you some salary support, and kind of start your funding trajectory on an entrepreneurial path. And you're going to find two things that you think that you can apply for.
Yeah, I like that. Like kind of working backwards, like, all right, this is where I want to be. And then just kind of like, okay, let's break it down and work backwards, you know, and kind of create a path of how to get there.
Mm-hmm. And then maybe the next week is you're going to apply to one of those things, right? We're not saying that you have to get it or any of these things. No, you're going to put forth your best effort. We'll see what happens. Then we can reassess, take another look at that magical, happy, fulfilled you through the mirror. Is pursuing this next step going to get you to her? And if so, then okay, all right, let's think about the next step.
I like that because it's, I think in one of our episodes, Eric Gantworker talks about chunking, right? Chunking while he's teaching surgery. And it's the same thing, making small steps, taking small steps make, at the end of the day, consistently make big gains, big steps forward, which makes sense for any goals that we're trying to achieve. In terms of career transitions or making, you know, changes, do you find that people, when these moments come, is it something that's sudden? Do you feel like for most people, it's slow over time? Do they realize it?
I think it can be both. And I think it ends up being highly context specific as well. You know, so I think, like Ashley was saying before, sometimes it's just like you wake up with the Sunday scaries in the pit of your belly, but it's not just Sunday, it's every day. You're like, that's a sign, you know, that something is not aligned and is worthy of further consideration. But I think for other folks, it can be prompted by, you know, events that happen, right? So could be along the lines of you have a bad complication, or, you know, for me, a lot of my introspection came when I had to have my arm surgery and I was off on disability leave, you know, for several months. That was a time of like, okay, let's pretend that I can no, that I will not recover from this and I'm not going to go back to operating, who am I going to be and what is my identity tied to and what are the other ways that I can live as a fulfilled human being when something for so long that I was taught like my value comes from being a doctor and a surgeon. Let's take that out of the equation and who do I want to be and how do I pursue that? And what are the tasks that I'm still doing, even though technically I have to do nothing work related right now? What am I still choosing to do? Because that's probably an indication of where I need to be going with my career.
Talk to me a little bit. You said identity. Tell us a little bit how identity either can help make these transitions happen or hold you back.
For me, it is my personal belief that the most important kind of thought that I hold about my own identity is that I need to remind myself that it continues to evolve just as I do throughout the course of my life. Because otherwise, you know, going back to the thought of just doing the checkboxes that were put in front of you, you know, when you were a 20-something year old and you embarked on this journey, your identity is the checkboxes, right? Your identity is whatever score you got on X, Y, or Z exam, right? Your identity is your ability to execute these surgical tasks. And that might have helped, you know, when I was that 20-something year old trying to get through all of this stuff. But once you get through all of it, you're still evolving as a person and the anchors for your identity continue to evolve as well. And the problem comes if you're not in a place where you are allowing yourself to explore that and you just want to hold on to the identity that served you before, but now it's giving you the Sunday scaries every day because something's not aligned.
Yeah, I think that's very, very well put, kind of that holding on to that identity and holding on to this is what I'm supposed to be. This was, you know, just kind of that as if your life is, you know, a straight line. Because a lot of our training is, we get on this train when we're 18 and there's a stop every 4 or 5 years, but it's a straight line. Like it's kind of like you do this step, you do, you know, A, B, C, and then you get off the train. There's different paths and you can, you know, but it's like you're just holding on to, okay, this was the vision. This is what it is. And it's, you're just trying to kind of cram a square peg in a round hole. It's insanity. And it also is insane to expect an 18-year-old to know what they want to do for the rest of their lives or a third-year medical student to know what they want to do for the rest of their lives and to have them, you know, to know they want to commit to being an otolaryngologist after doing a 4-week rotation. But that's the way it is.
I also think identity, I think you put it well, Jen, like sometimes it's at that age when we're trying to do the med school, the residency, you know, you have these numbers, these scores, you know, pass, fail, like these board scores, things that kind of are part of your identity. And then early in your career, you have these titles and positions. But I think at a certain point, identity becomes beyond that. The titles and positions don't always carry you. And so it may be more to what are my identity is, what are my values, you know? And the other thing is, I do think that sometimes your needs and even your values change over time. And perhaps the system that you are in, you've either outgrown that system, right? Because as we evolve probably more and faster than the system around us, depending on, you know, where we are. And so I do think that at this point, as you said, Ash, it's kind of silly to even think that, hey, I'm going to be at the same place for 30, 40 years. I'm expected to know what I want to do for the next, you know, in my 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, you know, whatever. And so there should be more room for that exploration, whether it's time versus even just giving space, right, to our peers. I had a career transition, you know, I was at UT Southwestern for a long time. I loved it. I loved my practice. I was there for almost 10 years, about 9 years exactly. And now I'm doing locums, pediatric ENT, and I love it. It's, you know, at the Scottish Rite in Atlanta. And I love it because I still enjoy having a clinical practice, but it's set up completely differently. And I have it, you know, on my own terms, and it's great. And yeah, there's some balls in the air and there's definitely some other things that aren't like, you know, set down and this is how it is. You know, it's not like this path laid down in front of me, but at the end of the day, you know, it's been good because it's given me the opportunity to do other things that have become more important for me when it comes to medical education and advocacy. But I remember having to giving a talk at a conference, and the what is your name, you know, your title and what you do, what's your intro going to be? And I was like, well, man, you know, I'm not associate professor and fellowship director anymore at UT Southwestern. Like, I'm a locums provider for ENT. And it took me a second to be like, you know what? That's great, because I'm loving what I'm doing. How is that title now and that identity tied? You know, when we get so attached to these things and allow those things to define us and give us value. And now, you know, after kind of having to think about that a little bit, get comfortable with it, I'm like, yeah, this is great. I love it because I know what I do. I know what makes me happy. Like, that's okay, but it's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Don't you wish, because so much part of this conversation too is we only feel comfortable sharing our successes, right? Like, when that introduction happens, right? They're showing all the successes. But like, my next grand rounds, I want them to be like, she submitted a grant in 2018 that was a true turd, and it was triaged immediately out, right? The reviewers didn't even read it. It was so bad after the first three paragraphs, right? But she tried again, and she took a grant writing course, and then she submitted another grant. Better written, but still not funded. Right. Just to show, like, so much of the trajectory is like doing these experiments in our own lives that like don't work out. But I think so much of who we become is based on those things that didn't quite work out, but we learned something and then we persisted anyway.
Yeah.
And I think that's a much better lesson than just like, so and so is an associate professor, blah, 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 and has XYZ grant, yada, yada. Okay, whatever. Like, what I want to know about a person when I'm about to listen to a lecture is, are they kind? And do they have content that's going to help me in some way evolve into the next iteration of myself? And that is not predicated on what level of academic seniority they have or how many millions of like research funding they have. They're two completely different things.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about suffering and martyrdom. And I feel like in medicine, at least like in surgical specialties, I feel like there is a culture of like, it has to be hard. Like, if you're not like suffering, then you're not doing it right, you know? Like, and it's taken me a long time to kind of call bullshit on that. But I mean, have you ever looked into the research? Like, is there research about that? Like, does it just seem that way because that's kind of been my bubble? Or does everybody feel like that?
Yeah, I think that there is very much an unspoken but pervasively known secret in medicine, right? The culture is toxic for exactly the reason that you mentioned. And I think it's compounded by the fact that so many people are so linked to this idea of you just do the things. And because we don't feel that we have a lot of agency as we're doing the things, and that we tend to be a competitive group, then rather than competing about who can have the most fulfillment in their life or who is doing the training, but also still doing things that resonate with them, the easier thing to do, because we're trained to see problems anyway, is to just turn all of our problems into a competition. And so the altar of our success is now how much are we willing to endure and suffer and give away. And I always tell my students, I'm like, listen, medicine is hungry. Whatever you put on the menu in terms of what you are willing to sacrifice, it will order it. So don't be putting stuff on there that you know is going to make you feel at the end of the day when you're done with your career that you didn't get the most out of your life. And so for a lot of women, that's having children, right? And so I remember having a conversation with one of my senior residents who, super crotchety guy, this is not the advice that you would expect to come out of his mouth. But he looked at me and he was like, they'll walk, bleep this place. He was like, you do whatever you need to do to feel like you lived a full life. Because at the end of the day, if I were to die right now, yeah, my colleagues would mourn me and people in my life would mourn me, et cetera. You know who isn't? The health system. They're going to be like, man, we got to figure out call coverage now. And then a couple months from now, I will be replaced. Right. So why would I put things on the menu that are going to impact me for the rest of my life in terms of that ability to feel like I had a complete life that was aligned with the things that I cared about and the things that I needed to become and evolve into a complete human? They're going to order in every time.
Jen, tell us a little bit about career transition and it sets the martyrdom and that sort of, if you put it out there, they're going to take it. It sets the stage for this. But tell us how career transitions can relate to burnout or career longevity.
Yeah, I think that sometimes those transitions are needed when you figure out what you're running towards, right? What is happening today isn't working. You have articulated this amazing vision of what your future needs to look like. And, you know, like Gopi, you said, sometimes it's that hard realization that you have outgrown the place where you are, right? Or you have outgrown the parameters that were helpful to you as you were going through X, Y, or Z thing. But now you have evolved. The shoe doesn't fit anymore. And you got to do something else. And, you know, then that's not to say, you know, make decisions and just, you know, launch yourself into something new. But it is to say that you should at least be aware of what all the other options are, right? And I think that's why so many of the websites, you know, for like physician side hustles and this, that, and the other are becoming so popular, is because people are looking for those other avenues to explore so that they can learn from the stories of others and then make informed decisions about where they would like to go. And I think for a lot of people, they stay involved in clinical medicine, you know, so it's not a but type scenario, you know, or like a completely diverging, but wanting to fulfill different aspects of yourself that clinical medicine isn't able to do right now.
Yeah. I think, you know, the topic of physician burnout and the statistics around depression and suicide in physicians, you know, it has definitely gotten a spotlight over the last several years. So there's a lot more awareness. And I do think coaching and career transitions have helped people maybe, you know, pivot or make changes in their life that help kind of pull them out of that or you know, make the changes that they need to have a more fulfilling career in life. For you, can you talk a little bit about your relationship with depression? And I know you did a really amazing TED Talk that kind of talked about, you know, the black hole of depression, and, you know, would love to kind of hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, big topic, right? Mental health, you know, yeah. In society as well as, you know, in medicine in particular. But, you know, I think that the thing that makes me the saddest when I reflect on mental health and medicine and medical education is this pervasive desire to always present the grand rounds introduction version of ourselves to everybody. Right. You only want to present like the shiniest, best version avatar you that's out there. And I think that really prevents us from connecting. Right. Because if all you see is my list of accomplishments, I am not a real person to you anymore. Right. Nor does that list of accomplishments reflect who I am as a real person. So then, you know, if we're going to talk after a lecture or something, we're going to talk about like the topic of the lecture or blah, 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 career advancement, yada, yada. But what we are not going to do is connect as human beings, right? So I'll build my professional network of people that know the avatar version of me and whatever seems to be important from an academic side of things. But you know who I'm not going to have with that approach? I'm not going to have people like Gopi that I can text and I'm like, I have just had myself a doozy of a day, right? And I think those people are more important to have in your life, you know, than all of these peripheral, fancy-seeming other folks who only know you for these specific aspects of what you presented to them because you thought that's what they would value most about you. And then we wonder why we feel so lonely.
I think that's a great point. I think building relationships and finding true connection is so important. And it's something that, you know, it comes naturally. It kind of, it's situational. It has to happen in medical school. It has to happen in your training years. And maybe, you know, depending on the type of practice you have, it's built in a little bit. But over time, finding genuine, meaningful connection and putting time into it to build those relationships and connections are so vital and so important. I think we were talking about, you know, how do you find how do you find those connections and build your community? Because without it, you're alone. It's lonely. And so then what that sort of purpose or, you know, fulfillment, it's very difficult to find completely alone. And it happens fast. I think Vivek Murthy, the Surgeon General, you know, I was listening to one of the Ritual podcasts at Ash. I think you had sent me or, mm-hmm. you know, you listened to it. And he had a whole talk on, you know, loneliness and its epidemic right now. And so we have that within medicine. And so it is finding connection and meaningful connection, putting time into those relationships. you don't need like 100 people, but you need a handful.
Yeah.
You need a handful.
And you also need people in your life. You know, I think as physicians, we're fixers. And so it's very easy when our friends come to us, our colleagues with, you know, oh man, this day sucked, you know, and like, it's, I feel like I've definitely experienced the, well, you need to do, you know, let me tell you how to fix it. Like, let me tell you, you know, and it, what you really need are friends who can just, you know, hold that space for you and say, yeah, God, that sucks. Sorry, you had a bad day. You can talk to me about it or something like that. But there's just that in our nature, we want to fix the problem, and you have to kind of like check yourself to just be a friend and not be a fixer.
Yeah. And I think sometimes part of being a good friend is having the insight to know when somebody needs more help than what you can provide, right? There's more, something more is going on here than just needing someone to listen and hold the space for whatever strong emotion there is. You know, and to go back to your, you know, question about part of my journey, you know, I have suffered with two major depressive episodes in my life, and one I did not get any help and one that I did. Strongly recommend the help route overall. And, you know, I deferred my admission to medical school back in the day because, you know, I had been weaned off of medication and things at that point. And, you know, my therapist thought that, you know, I would be fine. But in the back of my mind, I was like, if I have another major depressive episode, I will not survive this. And, you know, that's a weighty thing to be considering. But there are so many, you know, there are so many people who have had these struggles, you know, with mental health. And there's also like this culture that being or having had these struggles or needing help somehow disqualifies you from being a good physician. And I would say almost the opposite, right? I'm like, I think that this makes you a better physician because you have understood, you can understand viscerally, you know, some of your patients that come to you who have been struggling with X, Y, or Z thing for however long, and everybody else in their life tells them it's not a big deal, and here's the way to fix it. And sometimes you have to be able to sit with your patients in that same way too and say, I do not know, but I believe you and I acknowledge your suffering. And I think if you've been through some of those things yourself, you're much more inclined to be that type of person. But we have to be open to getting help for ourselves as well, because there are some times where coaching is great, but there are other times where real, like, psychological, psychiatric help is also needed. And that doesn't disqualify you from being a good physician down the line. It just means that some stuff needs to get sorted out now so that that can happen in the future.
Yeah. I agree. I think you have to take care of yourself before you can help other people, you know, before you can put on your physician hat. Like, you have to be in the right place. And I 100% agree that being a patient makes you a better doctor in any capacity. I've experienced that as well.
I think the other thing is that we have to also remember being a physician's a journey. It's just part of our life journey, along with all the other things that make us who we are and all the other ups and downs and challenges, everything that, you know, it's a process. And so I think we are so endpoint driven, the checkbox driven, get the surgery done driven, cut, you know, get the cyst, the tumor, whatever it is out, you know, take the poly, you know, there's such an end goal that we have to remember that our careers in medicine, patient care, the nuances, the, you know, it's a journey. So, you know, I had to kind of really open myself up to that idea of like, there's so many different ways in which I can apply medicine. There's many different types of, you know, positions or healthcare, you know, pathways. There's so many different other things I can do with my time. And it's a process. And because I make a switch or try something doesn't mean I can't go back, or it doesn't mean it leads me to, you know, something even bigger, broader, whatever the right word is, fits better for me at that time than I would have even imagined. So I think going back to the initial valuing exploration and figuring out what are our values, getting comfortable in our skin. And that means getting comfortable with everything, you know, like our, you know, great qualities and the ones that we struggle with that we, you know, that we, maybe nobody else has noticed it, but you know, you always have stuff that you struggle with, and that's okay. And that is totally fine. So as we start to round things out and kind of any final pearls or words of wisdom or things that you want to leave our audience with, Jen?
I think you summed everything up nicely, but yeah, just it's my feet. be open to the exploration, right? And the experimentation. For those of us, you know, that have children or have been around small children, I would just offer that, you know, we see them experimenting and exploring all the time, right? It's why they run around dressed as superheroes and clothes that don't fit and high heels that are, you know, 8 sizes too big, right? Because they're trying on to see how it makes them feel. And when we see kids doing that, you know, we're not going to tell them like, that doesn't fit. You shouldn't explore, right? We encourage it because we want them to see what are the things that resonate with them that they want to then integrate into their little growing psyches as, you know, things that bring them power and make them feel good about themselves, et cetera. And I think one of the great tragedies as we age is that we become so outcomes oriented that we stop trying things on, right? We stop trying different ways of being, different ways of presenting, different ways of evolving. And I think, you know, in the context of career trajectory, those things are required if you'd like to change the path that you're on or confirm that you're on the right one, right where you are. That's important knowledge to have as well. So if anything, I would say just, yeah, put on your superhero cape every now and again and try something new and see where it leads you.
I love it. It's great.
Thank you so much for taking the time, Jen. For any of our listeners that may want to reach out to you, are you on any social media? And if not, they can also reach out to us at Backtable. We can always relay a message.
Yeah, the current stage of my evolution is one where my social media only includes pictures of insects and plants in my garden. So, yeah, reaching out.
It's a beautiful garden. You've like orchards instead of peach trees and bees. It's amazing.
Yeah, so if you're into home gardening, yeah, you can follow me. But otherwise, I'm readily findable online in terms of like my academic email and whatnot. And yeah, I'd be happy to connect further with anyone who's interested.
That's great. Also, make sure you check out Jen's TED Talk. And Jen, can you also tell us a little bit about the Faculty Factory podcast that you did at Johns Hopkins?
Yeah, that was a great opportunity to connect with another person who does a lot of coaching. So it's one of the deans at Johns Hopkins. So we had a lovely conversation just about, you know, different approaches to coaching and why it can be so helpful for folks as they're, you know, they're in that faculty, they're on the faculty treadmill, right? But they're wanting to do everything that we've talked about today in terms of find fulfillment on that trajectory and how to become that best version of themselves.
Y'all check it out.
I think it's a wrap.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us at @backtableent on Instagram, LinkedIn, or Twitter. Backtable ENT is hosted by Gopi Shaw
and Ashley Agan.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles,
Nick Shellcross,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz, with support from
Taylor Spurgeon Hess.
Social media and PR by Chi Ding.
Administrative support provided by Jamila Kennebrew.
Thanks again for listening and see you next week.